So, welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. With me today, I have Phil Barden. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Adrian. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. So, Phil, for the benefit of our listeners and readers, can you tell us a bit about you and a bit about the work that you do?
Yeah, I'm a consultant. I run a business called Decode Marketing in the UK. Mm-hmm. And we're a consultancy that specializes in understanding what we call the implicit processes in the brain. We apply this to brand owners, all sorts, whether it's B2B, B2C, and across marketing mix from brand strategy and positioning right through implementation to every touch point, so customer service, advertising, product design, propositions, and pricing, and in-store marketing and point of sale.
Okay. Is that something you've done for a long time, or is it that, what's your background prior to that? Because you've got quite a prestigious background.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I spent up until 5 years ago, I spent my entire career in marketing. I kind of grew up, if that's the right expression, at Unilever, and spent 16 years there, rising to marketing director. Then I spent 3 years at Diageo, and then the last 5 years at T-Mobile.
Okay.
I ran the consumer business in the UK, and then I became VP for brand development. Okay. In Bonn, in the head office. And in fact, that's where I became a client of Decode. They were originally founded in Germany by a group of scientists and academics who'd started to cross over from their world into the business and the commercial world. And
right.
The work that we did together, the projects that we ran, I found so not just exciting from a sort of intellectual curiosity point of view, but actually had real business impact. On the back of this work, we relaunched the T-Mobile brand, and the most famous and well-known manifestation of that is probably the Liverpool Street dance ad in the UK, which was in 2009.
Yes.
Where a group of people sort of start spontaneously dancing on the station forecourt. And that had unprecedented success in the market. It was the UK mobile market, as you probably know, is incredibly competitive.
Uh-huh.
You can't walk down any high street without sort of seeing at least one store from whichever one of sort of four or five branded competitors. And everyone's fighting tooth and nail to grab customers. And up to that point, it had all been about what we might call functional and rational items, such as network quality or who's got the iPhone first, or different propositions and, you know, who's giving more bundles of minutes and texts and mobile internet. And for the consumer, that's great because obviously that increases the value that they're getting. From the manufacturer, from the network operator point of view, margins were only going one way, which was down. So
sure.
T-Mobile really faced an issue in terms of what it was going to do. It had to relaunch or suffer the consequences because it had poorer quality scores and customer satisfaction scores than its competitors, and there was really no reason to buy T-Mobile until we relaunched and the proposition that we developed and the way that was brought to life and the effect that had in the brain ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
was very cogent. It led to a 49% increase in sales, which in a competitive market is enormous.
Indeed.
Brand consideration tripled. It doubled footfall into stores. It halved customer acquisition cost. And based on the success of that, we applied the same approach across other touch points. So bringing the brand to life in customer service.
Uh-huh.
And in the look and feel of retail store design and also in proposition development. And the net impact of that over 3 years, including more advertising based around the same approach, led to T-Mobile doubling its customer retention. So it went from having the worst churn in the market prior to the relaunch to actually being joint best and keeping having the joint lowest churn, which again is a sort of enormous commercial impact. And based on that experience, I started reading around the whole subject matter of neuroscience, behavioral economics, cognitive and social psychology. And the more I learned, the more sort of layers of the onion were peeled back, if you like, and the more aha moments I had. And suddenly light bulbs started popping in my head, because it was what I was learning from science and academia was answering many questions that I'd previously not been able to answer as a marketeer.
Right.
And just based on that experience, I decided to completely change tack, and I quit my 25-year client-side career to set Decode Marketing up in the UK. And that was about 4 years ago now.
Now you've just, I think on the back of that, you've just published a book called Decoded: The Science Behind Why We Buy.
Yeah.
Which I have in front of me, and it's great. I like the way it's printed. It's very graphic. It's quite a weighty sort of book, but not necessarily got too many pages in it. But tell us a bit about that, and what's the background and the main sort of thesis of the book?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Decoded was published about a week ago, and Amazon have already sold out, which I'm delighted about.
Fantastic.
It's certainly getting some interest already. The background to it is it's my journey. I was so enthused, as I said, by what I learned, that it gave me the confidence and conviction to change career. And that passion has only grown, if anything, since getting fully immersed in this area. And I just wanted to communicate my experience and what I'd learned, and really forge this bridge between the scientific world, what's been learned over the last X years in science and academia, and the commercial world, and particularly applying it to brands and businesses.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really what it's all about.
Okay. And what do you think are the main lessons for businesses following your sort of your experience, your journey, and what sort of things do you feel? I mean, because the thing that we focus on here on the blog and in the interviews, and I'm really, really interested in hearing about really interesting, cool things that companies are doing that might be obvious, might be counterintuitive, but just things that lessons that people can learn, as it were, and think about how do I apply that to my business.
Well, the book is packed full of case studies, things that people have done, and with explanations for why they've been successful or not. I think at a sort of meta level, if we kind of go a little bit upstream from the actual examples, the key lessons for businesses, I would say, again based on my experience, is that you need to challenge your existing models and ways of thinking about consumer or shopper or customer behavior. If the way you think about that is based on what I might call the traditional marketing models, so you know, the sort of models with which I grew up in those big businesses were originated in probably the 70s and the 80s.
Sure.
And they're based around very logical, rational, sequential models of communication and persuasion.
Yes.
You know, I have a product or service that has the following features and benefits. I need to communicate that. And what will happen in the mind of the consumer is they will be persuaded.
Mm-hmm.
They will do their own comparisons with competitive products or services. And if I can give them a reason to believe why I'm superior, then they will dutifully trot out and buy my product or service.
Yeah.
And that's predicated very much on a sort of a rational think, feel, and then do in that sequence. And what's been learned from science completely undermines that. What we've learned, and particularly in the last 10 years, has been more learned about the brain and how the brain operates than ever before, literally
right.
ever before. Previously, it was all hypothesis and model. And now with sort of modern brain imaging techniques and neuroscientific approaches allied to other fields. And I think this is interesting as well, because it's only when you bring together a sort of holistic view of, you know, neuroscience tells you some stuff, it's
yep.
fantastic at some stuff, but not at everything.
Yes.
Cognitive psychology adds a bit more colour. Behavioural economics adds some more colour. Social psychology adds yet more. And by bringing all of those together, which is what we do in the book, and certainly as a consultancy, we call the whole amalgam, if you like, decision science.
Right.
By bringing that together, what you realise is that the models we were brought up with are simply at best incomplete, and at worst they're wrong, and they can actually mislead you.
Is there is that picture also further complicated? I mean, if you think about the old models that we used to use in terms of marketing, is that also complicated by the plethora of choice that customers have these days as well?
Yes, and choice is there's this one study about the paradox of choice, because rather than we might think, well, if we give people more things to select from which to select, that'll make their lives easier because there's so many things they can choose. What actually happens is that tends to paralyze the brain, and,
yep.
and there have been some studies that show that less is indeed more.
Yes.
You can increase sales when you reduce your range of SKUs. And the key reason behind this is that the brain has evolved over millennia to be an organ that wants to work as efficiently as possible. And I mean that literally in the sense of the energy that's expended.
Yeah,
because the brain is a very energy consumptive organ. And when it's working in reflective reasoning mode, it's burning up to 40% of the body's available energy.
Right.
And that's why when you've had some time in the office analyzing data, really thinking hard through a difficult problem, afterwards you feel physically drained.
Yeah.
And you might well reach for a snack, is why people snack often when they're stressed, because the brain's been consuming all this energy. Now, the brain doesn't like to do that, because hardwired in our DNA is we need to preserve energy because it's critical for survival. You know, in years gone by, we couldn't stop to think whether that shape in the forest was a saber-toothed tiger or a friend. We had to move. And
yes.
The brain is actually, although it might sound counterintuitive, the brain's dominant mental processes are built for action rather than thinking.
Right.
And that's one of the key things about the paradox of choice. We don't want to reflect. It's anathema to us. And that's one of the ironies I face when I'm trying to sell consultancy in this area, because, of course, people have their own paradigms. And the irony of all this is that, as I said, brains don't like thinking because that change involves thinking. It's why change management in any business is so difficult, because it implies we need to move from the status quo, the default.
Yes.
And if the status quo has served us well in the past, we don't want to expend the energy to change it. So again, one of the lessons I would draw out for businesses and individuals is be aware of these inbuilt biases that we've got. There's a name even for that one. It's called the Semmelweis reflex, which is the propensity for us to reject information that challenges our existing models and paradigms.
Right.
But if only by me telling you this, it can make you aware of that tendency, then I hope I've done the listener a service.
Yes.
Because you can then say, okay, well, I know my default position is to reject something new.
Yes.
But actually there may be great value in this new thing. And so, one of my tips would be, my experience has completely changed my attitude to this whole area. That's another lesson that I would say for businesses. And again, one of the old models is, we need to change attitudes in order to change behavior. Whereas what science is telling us now is actually it's the other way around. That is,
right.
Behavior leads to attitude change rather than the other way around. A great example, I cite this in the book, is some work by Professor Brian Vanzig when at Cornell University. He was trying to get students in the university to eat more healthily.
Right.
And Of course, when you ask people explicitly, you know, should you eat more healthily, everyone's going to say, well, yeah, of course, it makes sense. Why wouldn't I? But they just don't. We don't. You know, we go for the burger and the fries rather than the salad or the vegetables.
Because secretly they taste better.
Well, they do. Yes, they do. And there is a link in the brain between this sort of, you know, the fat and the sort of unhealthy equals tasty link as well. But what Vanzink did was make some physical changes to the layout in the canteen that actually changed the students' behaviour.
Right.
And that then changed their attitudes. And it was, so it's possible, you know, the title of this was it's possible to changing behaviour without changing minds. And that's an interesting concept for businesses to think about.
So in the book, you give, I mean, going into sort of the case studies, I mean, there's a couple of examples I wanted to share with you because I thought they were, they sort of just jumped out at me based on the focus of the things I talk about in the blog. And one of the examples in the book, you give an example of how we can use these sort of insights, particularly in service businesses, and particularly when it comes to waiting and the behavioral cost of waiting. I think it's page 52 in the book. And you talk about how that can influence kind of behavior about, you know, use an example of, it's like about waiting for a train. Yeah. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. One of the background to this was a study into what's called the neural correlates of purchase decision, where Brian Knutson and his colleagues at Stanford University did some fMRI studies into when people were shown images of brands and then images of the price of the brand and then asked to decide whether they would buy that brand for that price. And Knutson essentially found that there's a very basic neurologic of purchase, which was that when people were shown brands, it triggered the so-called reward center in the brain, the orbitofrontal cortex, which is linked even with very profound human reward. So if you show a mother an image of her children, same part of the brain is triggered, it's activated. So this was significant to start with, that brands have a similar effect. So there's some sort of value, some sort of reward attached to the service or the brand.
Uh-huh.
What then happened was when they were shown price, a very different part of the brain responded. It was the insula, which is triggered by physical or social pain. So if we fall over or cut ourselves, that part of the brain's triggered. So it was almost as if the brain was metaphorically saying, yeah, I like that, there's some pleasure there, but ouch, I have to pay for it, there's some pain attached to it.
Sure.
So the neurologic was this basic equation of, if the value is sufficient to overcome the pain, then people would buy, and that's what the neuroscientists found, that ultimately the decision was positive if the net value of the equation was positive. So when we're looking at like things like waiting time in service businesses, this is similar to pain. So the cost that the cost side of the equation can be both explicit and implicit. The explicit cost is obviously things like the price. It's tangible, it's clear.
Yes.
But there's also an implicit level to this, and this is a recurring theme throughout the book and throughout our work, that the implicit processes in the brain are profound and dominant in the majority of our decision making. And implicit cost are things like behavioral costs. So waiting time is a classic.
Yes.
It doesn't cost you, well, it might cost you money if you're charging for your time, but it's also it's something we don't like doing, but it's a necessary evil in this case. And what the example in the book says that what service businesses were able to do is to mitigate that behavioral cost by providing some sort of other signal or value. So in the case of waiting for a train, we are more satisfied and content if we know when the next train is going to arrive than if we have no information whatsoever.
Yes.
So even if that's why stations now have got these digitized boards up that tell you, you know, how many minutes to the next train.
Yes.
We'd far rather know that, because it almost gives us some element of comfort that we know that it's on its way.
Yes.
It's a bit like when you download something from a website, if you get a progress bar, you kind of know that, you know, but what your progress is going through it, rather than having no idea where you are in the process.
Right.
And the same is true of service businesses when, for example, when people wait have to wait at garages. I mean, my own personal experience has been very variable depending on the service outlet. The best I have experienced was when I knew I was going to have to wait for my car to be serviced.
Mm-hmm.
But in the waiting area, they had a TV,
mm-hmm.
they had internet access, so there was Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
They had a free drinks machine for hot and cold drinks. They had newspapers and magazines lying around. And before I knew it, my car was ready.
Right.
Now, if those are quite simple, and you might say, well, that's fairly obvious. But the fact that they were there meant that behavioural cost was minimised because I could do other stuff.
Yes.
Also, the other great thing was that the guy behind the service counter told me, sort of halfway through, just spoken to the engineer, he thinks it's going to be another 20 minutes or so.
Yes.
Yeah. Great, fantastic. Now I know where I stand. And that, you know, that's a really good example of where you can take the pain away from this implicit cost, this behavioural cost of waiting.
I think that's great. I mean, it's very, very aligned to something I say to, you know, that some of my clients, where I turn around to them and say, look, if we want to build better relationships with some of your existing and or previous clients, the way that we need to think about things is think about things that we can do which have a marginal incremental cost for you, but a high perceived value for them.
Yes, absolutely.
And if it just takes it can bring those things closer. So like the Wi-Fi and the TV and the cost, it might feel like it's an obvious thing, but actually most people don't do it. And if you do it, you stand out.
Yeah. Well, a lovely example of this was cited by Rory Sutherland when he was president of the Institute of Practitioners in Advertising.
Uh-huh.
Rory has been he wrote the foreword to the book. I'm very grateful to him for that. And he's a real leading edge thinker and proponent of this whole area,
yes.
In particular behavioral economics. And he cited the lovely example of the Le Shuttle, you know, and how could they increase value. So the obvious response from the people working in the industry was, we need to reduce the journey time.
Right.
So how can we make this thing run faster between London and, say, Paris?
Mm-hmm.
And Rory had a completely different perspective. He said, well, you could do that, but, you know, how many billions of pounds are you going to have to spend on the infrastructure in order to make that happen?
Yes.
Yeah.
As an alternative, why not think of introducing a wireless network on all the trains so that people's time spent during the journey is far better utilized and more productive?
Sure.
And that, you know, you can do that for a fraction of the cost of the infrastructure of, you know, building faster engines or rails or whatever.
Absolutely.
And equally, he said, you know, why not improve the catering on the train? You know, you may find for a marginal incremental cost, you actually get people saying, could you make the journey 10 minutes longer? Because I'm enjoying this so much.
Well, indeed. I think that's the thing is that I guess one of the things I also think about is that we come at things from a very almost production line industrial economics perspective, because that's what we grew up with.
Yeah.
Our default position is make everything cheaper, faster, quicker.
Yes.
And that's not always the answer.
Absolutely, absolutely. But understand what is of value, then that's the point you made.
Yeah.
Understand what is of value. Understand this, the both sides of this equation, because it's not either or. You know, I can remember many long discussions with colleagues in businesses where there's this antagonism between the brand and the price. You know, the sales colleagues say, we have to reduce the price to shift more volume.
Yeah.
And marketing colleagues say, well, if you reduce the price, you damage brand equity. And the point is, in the human brain, there are both sides of the equation, and you can pull both levers.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's I think, an important lesson for businesses to learn. And, you know, those examples we've just given are proof perfect of that.
Excellent. So there's one other example that that also jumped out at me in the book, and it was all about customer loyalty cards, because I'm personally quite ambivalent about them. Some places they work, some places they don't. But where in the example in the book, you suggest that using loyalty cards that have more spaces, with some of the spaces pre-completed, has generally makes them sort of more successful. Can you explain about why that, how that happens, and why that happens?
Yeah, I mean, this is fascinating stuff. This was an example cited in the book of a car wash provider whose loyalty card was very simple. You get a stamp every time you get your car washed and we'll stamp your card. And you can redeem a full card for a free car wash.
Yes.
And you need to get 8 stamps, basically. So it was like, buy 8 car washes, you get the next one free. They tried an experiment. So they had one set of cards printed with 8 places for the stamps on the cards.
Yes.
They had another set of cards printed where they had 10 places, but they had pre-stamped the first 2.
Right.
So objectively and explicitly, they're identical. You've still got to buy 8 car washes in order to get your free one.
Uh-huh.
But what happened in reality was dramatically different. The cards that were pre-stamped led to a 70% sales increase compared to the other ones. And the reason for this is something that the scientists call process endowment.
Right.
When the 2 existing stamps that you're given trigger in the brain that you are on your way to completing a process, and there's some goal, there's some reward or value at the end of it, which is I get a free car wash. And if I'm already on my way, then I'm more likely to complete that journey.
Excellent.
The other effect is one that behavioral economists call loss aversion, which is that we value far more highly the things that we have than those which we don't have. If you've got a card that's already got 2 stamps on it, you'll value that more than one that is unstamped.
Fascinating.
It is fascinating and seemingly quite simple, because the marketing costs of that exercise are virtually 0.
Yes.
You can print it, you're printing a card anyway, so why not print one with 2 stamps already pre-stamped on it? It really is a no-brainer. Now, the other fascinating thing that happened in that study is when they did some follow-up research amongst the 2 groups of people who had these alternative cards, the ones that had the pre-stamped cards and then went on to complete them and hence had the 70% sales uplift,
mm-hmm.
also rated the quality of the service as better than the other people who had the unstamped cards. And their satisfaction ratings were better as well. So there was some sort of overall halo effect that was triggered by this as well, which is, again, absolutely fascinating.
Once you
understand this goes on, then why not do it?
Well, indeed, it almost implies that, in a way, what you're doing is if you're giving somebody something which is already partially completed, yes, you're almost already saying, well, I've just picked you, and you're already part of my gang, as it were.
Yeah, it could well be. Yes, there's some sort of a bit special. You're sort of in the club, in the inner circle.
Well, exactly, and fascinating. I can see all sorts of applications for that.
Yeah.
So, in your view, do all these lessons apply to smaller firms as well as larger firms as well as service firms? You know, is it the lessons are broad and far and wide reaching?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a very simple reason for that, because we're all human beings with brains. And, you know, I hear people say to me, oh, it's all very well, but this won't work in B2B. Or it's all very well, but, you know, you're telling me about a product brand and I've got a service brand. That's an artificial divide.
Yes.
Because, as I said, you know, the common denominator is we're human beings. We are subject to the same biases, motivations as everybody else. So,
sure.
Yes, the lessons that I've learned, and I've worked on the product side and in the service brand side with T-Mobile, and whilst I haven't personally worked in B2B, I have applied this approach to B2B, and I've worked with a lot of B2B colleagues. you may find that B2B buyers respond to different signals. Mm-hmm. They may have different goals, but that's fine. It's the same brand. You don't need to, you know, the brand shouldn't be different because they don't change their brain when they go home at night, when they suddenly become a consumer and exposed to the same advertising as Joe Public. Yeah, it's the same brand, it's the same person. You might need to pull a few different levers, but you can use the same kind of generic findings, principles, and guidelines that I cite in the book, irrespective of your business.
Fantastic. So on the back of all that, if I were to ask you to provide me with your top three tips or recommendations for marketeers, executives, entrepreneurs that come out of the book, what would they be?
I think they would be suspend judgment, challenge, and what I mean by that is be prepared to be challenged by what's been learned about the human brain.
Okay.
Because if you can embrace this, you can turn it to your business advantage. If you don't, fine, carry on doing what you've always done and you'll get the results you've always got. But if one of your competitors embraces it, then more for you, because you know why wouldn't you embrace what the learnings and the teachings from science. I found it works absolutely profoundly and cogently across different types of businesses. So I think that's the key thing. Be prepared to challenge yourself. I think the second thing is steal with pride. You know, there are lots of examples in the book that you could take and apply to your business, and just try it. Why not try it? Do a test, do a pilot study.
Yes.
Just try it. And there's some things in there that are so simple and at zero or negligible cost. Why wouldn't you try it?
Okay. So that was two. You got a third one? Are we okay with two?
I think we're okay with two.
Okay, that's fine.
If people do that as a result of this podcast, you know, if people are willing to do that, then I will think, yeah, good. Thank you. Thanks for listening.
Fantastic. So, Phil, I always end these interviews with one final question. And that question is there anything that you would like to shamelessly plug?
Yes, of course. Thank you for the opportunity. Of course, I will shamelessly plug my book, Decoded, The Science Behind Why We Buy.
Brilliant.
If you don't want to jump in and buy one straight away, you can find more about the book on a website that I've set up, which is decoded-book.com.
Okay.
Which tells you more about the content and about some of the learnings. There's some testimonials up there. So, you know, social proof is another cognitive bias that's very powerful. So on there, I've got testimonials from clients, as well as, you know, notable leading thinkers, people like Mark Earls, author of Herd and I'll Have What She's Having. He said that Decoded is a must read. And I've got citations on there from eminent leading edge neuroscientists and economists such as Professor Colin Camara from Caltech.
Okay.
So you know, if you need a bit of a nudge in order to buy it, then they're on that website, decoded-book.com.
Phil, that's brilliant. I'll make sure I get all that linked up and edited when we edit the podcast, so then we can give you a big shout out for the book. But that's been fascinating, and I think there's some real meaty stuff in there and some real sort of like some big nudges to go off and look at things differently, which is fantastic. So thank you for that.
Okay, no, you're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity. I look forward to the output.
Fantastic.
All right.
All right, thank you.
Phil, thanks, Abe. Cheers now, bye.
Cheers.